Hello and welcome to another edition of the podcast Living with Dying. And today I'm really honoured to be joined by what I would call the guru of death and dying, Professor John Troyer, who is Death Scholar at Large for the Centre for Death and Society at the University of Bath. John, I've been doing this podcast for almost 3 years and I've interviewed 76 people up to now, but I feel like an absolute beginner, novice and amateur compared to you. You seem to have been involved in death really from your childhood.
I was. Thank you. That was a wonderful introduction and thank you. Yes, I have. So I moved to the UK about over 15 years ago now. And I came from the States originally, and my father, Ron Troyer, was a funeral director for about 35 years in America. I also worked in mortuary science as an instructor. So I grew up around death and dying, from the moment I was born, really, and then ended up doing PhD work, had never intended to end up working around death and dying, but that's what happened. And then ended up becoming part of the Center for Death and Society after it had opened, fortuitously enough, after I had finished my PhD. So that was just a series of circumstances that all kind of lined up that way.
So what kind of perspective did you get on death from your childhood, really, with your father? You weren't living in a funeral home, were you?
No, we never lived in the funeral home. Yeah, but I was certainly around. I mean, I think the easiest way to describe it for anyone who's curious about that, and if anyone has grown up around funeral homes, either lived in them or just, been around the industry, then there's no way really to separate at least in our family, because my parents, my mom and my dad, certainly never hid it or made it seem like it was something we couldn't talk about or ask about. And absolutely, as kids, I have younger sister Julie, who sadly died in 2018, which is a whole other experience. But that, we were always around the different funeral homes my dad worked at. And it was just going to see where dad worked. It was really uneventful, what I would say, which I think most people don't have uneventful experiences at funeral homes. Whereas I grew up being really bored in them because we were waiting for like my dad to finish, hoovering or moving chairs or, flowers. And we're like, can we go? So, I mean, it was just a different experience, but certainly absolutely grew up around everything around that. Yeah.
But it kind of normalized it for you, even if you didn't.
It absolutely normalized it for you. It normalized it. My sister and I would talk about that. It normalized death and dying in ways we did not really realize how normalized it had become until we were kind of teenagers. And actually, in some cases, even in our early 20s, and we would be hanging out with people and talking with friends about just how we grew up, and be like, what? What happened? And it would be something involving death and dying. Like, no, that's not how we grew up. I'm like, well, yeah, it was totally normal. That's just the way it was. So it did. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely normalized it.
I read in one of the pieces you wrote that your sister would recognize funeral homes wherever you went. She was able to.
Yeah, we both would do that. Yeah, no, we would do that all the time. And it's still something I can do, and I can't explain it, but I can, from a distance, even before I see a sign, whether it's a storefront or an app, like just a building, I don't know why, I don't know how, but I'll be like, that's a funeral home.
But are you actually saying that your background didn't really have anything to do with your choice of future?
It did. Absolutely, it did. But it wasn't. So having grown up around death and dying isn't why I went to graduate school to get a PhD in the States. But while I was doing my PhD at the University of Minnesota, Minneapolis, in an interdisciplinary studies PhD program where I could kind of pick and choose whatever I wanted to build a PhD around, which was great. I kind of stumbled upon just some 19th century memorialization practices that I became really fascinated by, and then began looking at the convergence of different forms of like early photography and early embalming and other forms of just things that there emerged these methods for different kinds of ideas of funerals and how we thought about dead bodies in the 19th century. And as a result of that, I was like, well, I kind of grew up around death and dying. So maybe I should go ask my dad about it. And I did. And he was like, well, here, I'll give you some of my textbooks from when I was, you know, teaching. And he did. And that, I was just off and running. And that was it. So it didn't start out that way. It happened that way. But because I've got a background in death and dying, it opened up a world that I, on the one hand, was already kind of familiar with, but became a world that I became even more intrigued by, because there are parts of it I didn't know about. And as such, you know, just having grown up around it, there wasn't as big a leap, maybe, to try and become familiar or comfortable with it.
How do you feel about how we handle death today, given your look into the history?
I think one thing to bear in mind is that every country is different. Even within countries, every local community can be different. But that, I think one of the things that has most certainly happened is that I don't think people are afraid, really. Some people have a deep fear of death and dying, and I know that. And that's similar to a deep fear of death and dying. And the way a lot of people are just afraid of lots of different things, I would say, like spiders or snakes. Or, you know, I mean, I'm not trying to belittle it, but what I'm saying is there will be people genuinely who have a deep fear. But I think a lot of people, it's not that people don't want to deal with it or think about it or you know, be around it. It's just that because of advances and successes in medical care, for example, but also access to clean water and food, any number of changes in public health, which are all for the better. I wouldn't want to, you know, change any of that. It's just become so much less common to be around death and dying in a daily way that until relatively recently, certainly in the West, it was. Now, different parts of the world, you're talking about the global South or the developing world, however you want to think about it, you know, death and dying is a much more everyday experience. And so there's not that luxury of being, you know, I'm separated from it. But, you know, the way I talk to my students about this too sometimes, I say, you know, it's true that in the Victorian period, more recently, say in the UK, it's true that there were lots of different ways to think about death and dying, all kinds of, you know, elaborate clothes, not so elaborate clothes, but different things at funerals. And there were all these elaborate kind of funeral practices. And I said, well, one of the reasons that happened was because, you know, everybody died in the Victorian period in ways that we're just not familiar with in the West. And I think so I think that as we've become more distant from it, it just becomes something we've just fallen out of habit or practice in knowing what to do. And that actually in many ways makes complete sense to me. It just does. Like, it's not, I'm not shocked or actually surprised by any of those changes. And in fact, I think, you know, it can actually become quite shocking for many of us in the West, first world, global North, however I think about it, when we are encountering a rapid sort of death event, which I think we saw in different elements in different parts of the COVID pandemic with deaths. Like, I think it was really shocking for people, you know, particularly in the UK, America, and the West, but like to see this, like, oh my God, there's people dying everywhere that way. So we can't see it. And then we realize, oh, but what do we do? But I think that as people become more familiar with funerals and death and dying, I think it just, you know, it becomes something people do. I always encourage people to think about it and talk about it. There's nothing against it. I mean, certainly that's something my students learn. Like, oh yeah, I really like talking about this. It's really interesting. And I like talking to my friends about it. Like, it's really good. So I think that has just become part of, you know, how we think about death and dying today.
I think in many ways, COVID didn't help, did it? Because although there was a lot of death and dying going on, it was all very much behind closed doors.
Well, it was, yeah. I mean, so I think one of the things that what has developed over the last number of decades, and I've written and thought about this in different ways, is there is an infrastructure. There's absolutely what I would refer to as a national death infrastructure that all countries have in different ways. And that death infrastructure is there for the moving, the maintenance, the care, for example, of, in particularly the dead body, but also to a certain extent, the dying person. But that it's rare that we ever see that infrastructure become visible. And when it does become visible, it's because of some catastrophic event. It's not an infrastructure we're familiar with. But, you know, the dead bodies have to be moved somewhere. They can't just be left, you know, on their own. And I think that in COVID, you know, we really began to see the infrastructure, and, you know, and in many ways it held up, although it was under strain, and there'd be funeral directors and other people who work around death and dying say that, well, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't as robust as we might have liked, but it did. And I think that that was, I think one of the offshoots of that in trying to deal with such a huge spike in the number of individuals who died was it just became impossible for lots of different reasons for families to see the deceased, even if they wanted to, you know, that kind of thing. So you're right. I think that it was, but it was obvious people were dying. I mean, I have these distinct memories. I'm sure many people do, certainly in America, where I spent a lot of the pandemic because I got stuck there during the lockdowns, but which was great because I was spending a lot of time with my parents. You know, there would be the daily, you know, the Chiron on the TV with like the, you know, listing the number of people who had died. And that, you know, that hadn't really happened before. There hadn't been a thing like that in America, not really since, you know, Vietnam and the, you know, the weekly listing of names of people who had died. Anyway, so I agree. I think all events are different, but I think we have these events where we glimpse that there is more death happening than we might realize.
One of the most impactful things that I've done since I started this series was going to visit a crematorium and go behind the scenes. And I have to own up to the fact that I was nervous, and I don't know what I was nervous about seeing.
Sure.
And having seen it, of course, it's normalized it for me, and it's a sure. very proficient, efficient service and process, and I was glad to have seen it. But yeah, I acknowledge that I felt butterflies before I went in.
Sure. And I think that's normal. I think it's normal. I think something that's unexpected, but also too, you know, the experience of death and dying is one that is... It can be uncomfortable for people. I'm not saying it's easy in any way. And even for people who grew up around it, like, you know, I have. I mean, it's not like you never want to be cavalier about it, or you never want to be just sort of brush it off. So it can be uncomfortable, but can also be just sort of, in a way, kind of unknowable, in a way that you're like, wow, what am I going to walk into? And then I think, certainly in the case of crematoria, it is, I think what strikes a lot of people when they go, if they go in and see the actual crematoria and how it works, sometimes what's referred to as behind the scenes, right? And it's sort of the actual, the furnaces and the equipment, it's just how distinctly industrial it is. But that is what we're talking about. Like, it's not... you know, and that is something that is just to, you know, to be understood. So sometimes I wonder if the shock is at the death part or the industrial part, or maybe both. But we are talking about, you know, that kind of sort of death and kind of contemporary technology interface. And that makes complete sense to me.
Does have to be industrial, doesn't it? But most of us don't have any idea what happens if we leave a hospital or a hospice, or we have somebody die with us. We don't know where they go next. We really don't.
And I think for some people they're fine with that. I think a lot of people, some people would like to know and would like to follow. And you can, and I would always encourage. I always encourage people, like, listen, if you, for example, you can always request different things with however someone who has died, a deceased, you know, family member, whatever it might be, you can always say, you know, like, I'd like to participate in this. I'd like to participate in that. And then I have sort of background knowledge in this. So in fact, I said to the funeral home, you know, after my dad died in 2022, you know, I really want to be part of dressing my dad, like, you know, dressing his body for the funeral and stuff like that. And they're like, sure, come on over on, you know, Wednesday morning, and we'll do that with one of the funeral directors. And I did, and it just meant a lot to me to do. And so, that's the kind of thing that different funeral homes might have different reactions to it, but there's not really anything per se preventing people certainly from asking, and there's nothing wrong with it, nor is there anything abnormal. And I think it's completely normal to want to be, to participate in those kind of events.
If we talked about it more, that kind of thing might happen more and become more
accessible. Good. Yeah. Yeah. If we talked about it more, and also too, I think, I mean, I often wonder, like, if we talk about it more, though, you can make the case that it's hard to go by a day where death isn't talked about. We may not be talking about our own individualized deaths or deaths of family members, which I understand and I appreciate, and people don't want to talk about per se. But I also too, I do wonder if if we were talking about it a lot more, I would wonder too if in some ways that maybe meant a lot more people were dying. I don't know, but certainly you can have the conversations. I think it's important just to give people opportunities to have the conversations. So one of the reasons I really enjoy teaching my sociology of death class, which is now, was for a long time just one semester, now it's a year long, we have different people coming in. You know, for final year undergraduate students, who it's an optional unit so they can take it if they want to. But a lot of them, they'll just say like, I really enjoy talking about death and thinking about it. And a lot of people thought I was crazy for taking this class, but it's just so, it's so interesting. And it's so like compelling to talk about. And it's not weird. And it's not kind of creepy. And it makes complete sense to me to want to do it. And all the class does is give them an opportunity. That's all it does. It doesn't, you know, it's not telling them to do this, although I guess in a way it encourages it because that's the class, but it's in the title of the class. So it just gives them an opportunity to do it. And I think that's what a lot of people need. They just need the opportunity.
Are you teaching them about the history of death and dying, how it's been handled in various countries, or are you just talking academically?
So this semester is much more cross-cultural, different countries, different perspectives. The first semester was there's lots of history involved in it. I mean, to be sure, there's no way around. Like I think one of the things that students find fascinating is the history around the definition of death. For a lot of them, they hadn't ever, a lot of them will just say, like, I never thought that there actually was a definition of death, but of course there's a definition of death. Furthermore, I'd never thought about the fact that that definition might have changed over the years in terms of criteria and how it's understood. So I think that for a lot of them, it's just opening up these ideas that they had never really even thought about. And that's good. I think that's really good.
And something else of yours that I read about was how in Germany they didn't have a method of checking whether somebody was dead or not. So they used to leave them with bells and things attached to them.
Oh, yeah, the different architecture. Well, there's different countries over different times. This is much more of a 18th, but also 19th century phenomena where there was great concerns about being buried alive. And so there's different architectural devices that would be, I love some of these where, and you can still come across some of these where, you know, there would be like a little bell device where there'd be a string tied to a person's hand or something like that. So that if they woke up in the grave, they could pull the string and the bell would ring and they'd know that they weren't dead and they could go in there and dig them. But yes, there were different devices that they tried to do that with. Yes, absolutely.
But as for the definition of death, what is it? What's your definition of death?
Well, there's different, that's a great question. What is the definition of death? Well, there's a legal medical definition, which is using, there's two ways to sort of medically and legally describe death. It's either going to be cessation of heart activity or cessation of different parts of brain activity. And that becomes a legal definition. The heart was always and remains easier to use, in part because once the heart stops and if it is not restarted, it will absolutely cause a person to die unless it spontaneously restarts because we need the blood flow for the oxygen. The brain has been the criteria, neurological criteria is a criteria that has become more universally-ish used, although there are different religious groups that use, lots of religious groups at times, who still use heart criteria. But the brain criteria gets into then discussions around how much of the brain are we talking about. And there's actually an ongoing discussion right now, but we need to reevaluate how we think about brain death in as much as different neurologists and medical people are thinking, you know, we want to think more about how the brain works. The way I think about this is, you know, it's interesting to think about it, for a lot of people, what it comes down to is, you know, for a long time, the heart, it made sense that, you know, the heart was what was used because you could hear it, you could feel it, it would stop. And I think that, you know, philosophically, there's an interesting point here, which is, and I ask my students this, I'm like, one thing you have to think about is, so where do you think the person is? Is the person in the heart or is the person in the brain? And a lot of times where you position that is where you come down on which one do I want to use for the definition of death, which is, you know, is in some students will be like, are you talking about the soul? And I'm like, I could be, if that's what you want to talk about, you know, but is the person, where would you locate the person that you know in there? And I think that, you know, for a long time, it was the heart. It was the heart is where we thought of everyone. And as that's moved into more of a, we think of, you know, individuals as being sort of cognitive creatures, as we move into the brain, that's kind of where we, you know, begin to think about the elements of death that way. So, I mean, for me, you know, death is always an ongoing thing. I mean, certainly with, you know, the pronouncement of death is going to be based on a causation, which is going to be medical, and that then becomes like a legal pronouncement. But, you know, when is a person dead? That's as a metaphysical question, that's a great question. Because I think about that a lot. I'm like, you know, I'm not sure. Obviously, a person's not around. Does that mean they're dead? I'm not sure they're dead, but they're not around. They're certainly alive in how I think about them and you know, talk to people who are dead that I know, all kinds of things like that. So I think that on the metaphysical individual level, that becomes a much broader question. But that will always be separate from how we think about it in terms of other, I guess, more clinical and judicial settings, if I can be super technical about it.
Can we talk now a bit about your own experience? Because I know you've lost three of your family members, and the first one to die was your sister. And I wondered how you felt, if you felt, your experience in the world of death and dying had prepared you for this. Or not?
Yeah, no, thanks for asking me. No, yeah, because my sister Julie, younger sister, she died from brain cancer in, she's 43 in 2018, July of 2018. And then my mom died from colon cancer in May of 2022, so 4 years later. And then my dad died about 6 months later in November of 2022. He had a bad heart, he had cardiovascular problems. And I mean, it was a lot. It was a lot of, as a friend of mine said to me, she's like, you know, you've been through a lot. Like, that's a lot. And it was a lot of people to have die, certainly my most immediate family members, because I'm now the sole surviving family member, have died in that close succession, and to be part of all their deaths in such a way, because I wanted to be. And I felt a certain need to, you know, be involved and be there. I think as far as growing up, there were practical things I understood that had to be done, like things about planning. You know, what does it mean when we're talking about someone being in hospice care, but also then things like, you know, even things like, okay, so how are we going to arrange a funeral? Like, there are practical things that I just knew how to do, really, as much as having grown up around it as anything. One of the things I told my dad to do years ago, which he then did, which was very helpful, was, you know, make sure and write down on paper and update all your passwords and logins and everything. So, because at a certain point, we're going to need all those. And he did all that, actually. And that was a major, major help. If anyone's thinking, what should I talk to my parents or loved ones about? Like, just make sure someone's got all that stuff written down in a safe place. But do it, because it makes a huge difference. But then, you know, as far as like, you know, an emotional, like this happening, I mean, parts of it just totally got me off guard. Like it wasn't as if grief and bereavement were, I mean, I knew all about grief. I could go through all the literature. I could talk at length about all of it. But I still, like, it took the better part of a couple of years, even after my dad had died, and still today. Still, I mean, we're in 2026. It'll be 4 years since mom died in May. I mean, it took some time to really kind of figure out just how I was experiencing this, their deaths, and what it just physically felt like. And it was wearing on me in ways, and I was doing things. I was like, I know exactly what I'm doing. Like, I'm, you know, I this is a classic kind of almost PTSD experience. Like, these things that are happening. And so I knew that. And I was like, I guess maybe I thought that knowing all of this would somehow or other not shield me from it, but help me to like negotiate. I'm like, oh my God, I'm in the middle of this. And so that was, and I don't know if there's any way you can prepare for that other than I knew a lot of it was, this is normal. You know, that's the thing I kept saying. This is normal. This is normal. There's nothing adverse going on here. So that's not to be. Doesn't mean I still didn't become a big hypochondriac for a long time. Like, just any slight health thing, I was like, oh my God, I'm gonna die. I'm dying right now. I can tell. Like, you know, and that's also normal too. So I get that.
I was really interested that you described how the hospice carers and the counsellors and the people around your sister were not telling her she was dying. And then you went to visit her and decided that was a good idea to tell her, didn't you?
Well, yeah. No, well, yeah, a couple of things happened. So you're right. My sister was in Italy, right? And she was dying in, she had excellent hospice care in Italy. So she was doing outpatient home-based hospice care. And she'd been in hospice care for a while, and they weren't talking about death and dying. No one was saying dying. And I've checked now with some Italian like friends and colleagues, and like, I get that. I mean, that's kind of normal. That's not abnormal to try and do that. And so in July of 2018, mid-July, I was there in Italy with my sister in Milan, in case someone's curious, outside of Milan. And she just asked me what's going on. And I just said, Julie, you're dying. Like you're dying. We need to talk about this. And she said, okay, I know. And she died on the 29th of July. So it was just a few weeks later. It was not that long. And it was surreal. So it wasn't, I mean, different countries, different approaches, different hospice systems, different approaches. But I did think it was important that she knows, so we could begin thinking about what that would mean. And it did change the conversation. And she was very clear, like she did not want to die at home. She didn't want to be in the house when she died because they had two young kids, my niece and nephew, and she did not want them to think about, you know, mama dying in the house. So she had inpatient care then when she died, which was also excellent. And that really changed things around.
These conversations are so important, aren't they? And yet we all have a tendency to shy away from them, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, yes, and yeah. I mean, everyone's going to be kind of different. I mean, if I know someone's in hospice care, just for example, and this could be me just trying to be a professional, I guess, I don't know. And they said, you know, what do you think? Am I going to die? I'm like, well, if you're in hospice care, there is a much greater likelihood now. Yeah, and it's okay to talk about that, and it's okay to be upset and scared or angry or, you know, ambivalent, deeply philosophical, whatever it might be, you know, whatever it might be. And, you know, let's talk about that. But yeah, that's what it means.
More often. But it enabled you to have really good conversations, didn't it? And for your sister to talk to her mother and father in a way that she wouldn't have done otherwise, would she? Probably.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think so. But also too, like feeling a sort of sense of responsibility for it. Like, you know, we got to do this because if it's not being done by the people who I would think would be doing it, and that's not a criticism of them, then I will, because I, you know, I've got a family response, I've got a, you know, brotherly responsibility, you know.
I have thought about this a lot, and I've wondered whether the reason we don't raise it, even when we know somebody is dying, is because we hope that by not raising it with them, they will have the strength to carry on and fight come through. I don't know.
Yeah, I know the whole, like, you know, if you have a positive attitude, you can keep going kind of thing. And I think, I mean, there is something to be said for the will to live, like pushing people to, like, to not give up. And I think that's real. I mean, this has been studied, but I agree with that. I think that's real. In the case I'm talking about, like my sister's health was there. It was a glioblastoma. She was getting to a point where it was clear, like there was no coming back from that kind of really invasive, you know, advanced, you know, brain cancer. There was no way around it. There just wasn't. And then it was important to think about what that would mean and just making sure she was comfortable, you know, that kind of thing. And had a chance to say, you know, goodbye to people as much as she could. But also too, it gave us a chance to let, because prior to doing that, my family and my mom and my sister, there hadn't really been any big, no one had really said much to friends outside of the immediate friends in family in Italy. And I was like, there are a lot of people who are going to want to know this because they'll be hit twice. One is they'll be hit by the fact that Julie had terminal brain cancer, actually three times. Be hit by the fact Julie had terminal brain cancer. Two, that she just died. And then three, they're going to ask, why did no one tell me that this was going on? So I said, it's very important we get the word out that this is happening. And so we were able to do that. And that was, you know, that was very important. And we did that. And I know that it meant a lot to people to know that they were able to then to know that Julie had brain cancer and then died. Yeah.
So how has your personal experience of these three bereavements and three different kinds of grief and loss impacted your work?
It's a great question. How's it impact? So I didn't start out ever writing about grief and bereavement. I read about grief and bereavement all the time. It seems like, and I'm happy to do it. I genuinely am happy to do it. I mean, there's a couple of different ways. So, writing about it, writing, personal essays, reflections, different sort of like bits and pieces of just how I approach death and dying. I think one of the other things that came out of it was, so 2 years ago, I started with a colleague who's now retired, but I started the University of Bath Staff Loss and Grief Network, which is a staff group for everyone to get together once a month. All staff members are welcome, no matter what part of the university they're from, who had a death of whatever kind, whenever it was, could be very recent, could be a long time ago, just to get together and talk about, like the experiences, just to know it's okay to talk about death at work and, it's nothing wrong with you to feel lots of different things, but also to figure out what can we change at our place of employment to make it more supportive for people who've experienced loss and in death and dying that way. And that's actually been really meaningful to me. It's been really, it's actually, I think, been one of the most important things I've done, both academically, but also for my university, just in terms of supporting colleagues who just, I know because we've talked about it, just like, I felt like there was something wrong with me, and just to be able to come here and talk with people to know that there isn't, this is just what's happening. It really makes a world of difference. So that's actually been really, and I know my parents would be really proud of that, which is some people, every time people point out to me, I just sort of break down and like, yeah, I know. I wish I could tell them, but it's all right. That's the way it goes. It's not a radical thing. We just get everyone together in a room, what are we going to talk about? About an hour and 15 minutes, once a month, everyone gets together, and it's not even really a counseling session. Cause I mean, none of us are counselors. I'm not a counselor. I've no counseling training. I've never described myself as a counselor. All we're there is just to talk about, like, let's just talk about these things that have happened and like, the good, the bad, the like crazy, all of it and the absurdity of a lot of it. And I'm having this, I need to get some cremated remains repatriated. Has anyone had an experience with that? And people are like, yeah, we could do this. Or I've got this like, tax issues. Anyone ever have run up against this before, with a deceased parent? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So in many ways it has become very practical in terms of advice and experiences people have had about different ways to approach. I mean, we've even had like, a couple times like, okay, so there was death in a family. Can someone recommend a funeral home in this, area that they worked with? And that has happened too. I mean, these are all things that just happened. It was never set out that way, but it became a way for people to do that. I mean, there's some people who do not whatever in any way want to talk about the experience, and I get that. But I think a vast majority of people really do want to talk about it, and they want to know it's okay to talk about it. And so that's what we do.
John, thank you so much for talking to me.
Absolutely. It's a great pleasure. I really enjoyed this. Thank you so much for your great questions.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.